Good evening. Good evening, good listeners. This is Warrior Connection coming to you live and enthusiastically, hopefully, across this nation. My name is Patricia Axelrod. I'm going to be your host this evening. Generally, Doug Rocky is your host, and I'm the co-host oftentimes. But tonight, Doug is not available as he is engaged in some Veteran Day activities. So I shall be hosting this program this evening. And joining me is two very good gentlemen. One is Kevin Lucy. Kevin, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Patricia.
How are you?
Fine. Yourself?
Good. I'm great, thank you. Kevin is actually going to be co-hosting this program with me. And Kevin is the father of a young man who served in the Middle East and came home with PTSD, as many of our young soldiers do. Sadly, Kevin's son was unable to get help from the VA for his PTSD and subsequently hung himself. Also joining me tonight is Peter Lems. Peter, are you here?
I am. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you, and I'm glad you're here. Peter is an analyst working with the American Friends Service Committee. And Peter has lived in Palestine and has some firsthand experience with the human rights abuses of the Israelis against the Palestinians. And Peter tonight is going to be joining us to speak about the fiscal, F-I-S-C-A-L, cost of war, and the humanitarian cost of war. So, with that said, the name of our program tonight is Clean Wars, Dirty Lies, America's Addiction to War. We think that that is a fitting title for our program this Veterans Day Eve. On the eve of a night where many people had barbecues throughout the days and went to parades and perhaps celebrated VA, Veterans Day, while sadly Kevin visited the grave of his son. So with that said, Kevin, would you tell us about your son?
Well, our son enlisted in the United States Marine Corps when he was 18. He was a reservist. He signed up in 1999, and he was a freshman in college at that time. And people have asked us, why did he sign? And to be honest with you, we don't know. It was peacetime. And one of the remarks that Jeff would make is that he wanted to help people. And so Jeff went in, and after he went through boot camp and Camp Lejeune, he came back and was assigned over at a Connecticut reservist base in New Haven. From that time on, he seemed to be fine. He had a good sense of humor. He was very popular. He was social. And he seemed to be enjoying the reserves. But then, of course, September 11th came. And I remember that day when Jeff walked through the front door and he said, "This doesn't look good." And from that point on, Jeff wanted to be activated. He was hoping to be able to go down for the rescue and recovery in New York or to go to Afghanistan after the people that did this. But then when the war drums started beating for Iraq, Jeff was having issues with that because he couldn't see the link But anyways, on January of 2003, I believe it was January 14th, he was activated, and we brought him down in the darkness of night about 4 a.m., and he had to report to the fort in order to be deployed. And I can remember when Jeff was walking away from us and was being swallowed up by the darkness, whether this was going to be the last time I was going to see my son alive. And it's a very foreboding and lonely feeling. But then that was shattered when some of the other guys started yelling his name, and they all got together and they marched into the fort together. During the period of war, well, Jeff went to Kuwait, and he was there for a number of days, and he was complaining about the boredom, and but Jeff started writing a journal, and one of the things that Jeff wrote was that he was wondering whether he was going to be changed by whatever experiences he went through, or whether we would be changed by the time that he would return. And that was somewhat surprising for us when we read that, because Jeff was shown a sensitivity that an insight that he didn't really express when he was here with us that much. And then the final journal entry was on March 20th, when he said that a Scud missile went overhead and landed nearby, and it shook everybody up. And he wrote that that was the way that he found out that the war had begun. Jeff wasn't really in touch with us during the war as much. He wrote some letters, but he was expressing to his girlfriend especially that he had done things that he believed that he would have never done, that you see in the movies. And
what do you think those things were? I know you learned about these things afterwards, didn't you?
Yes. Subsequently, during Jeff's last few weeks, he had always worn these dog tags around his neck, his dog tags, and we didn't notice that there were two other dog tags. And one of the things is that his girlfriend brought it to our attention that she didn't think it was healthy. And so I can remember he shared with his sister, and then he shared with me, that they were dog tags of men that he thought that he was totally responsible for their deaths. And he shared with me in a very disconnected way. We were sitting on the deck outside, and we have like a forested area for a backyard, and he was just staring out, and he just said in a very monotone about how there were two men, and that somebody told him to pull the trigger.
These were two Iraqi men?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
these were men who had surrendered?
We don't know, but they were unarmed. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff identified with one of them because it was about his age, and he was wondering whether he was somebody's brother, somebody's father, somebody's son. And once somebody told him to pull the trigger, he did. And he didn't go on after that. And we didn't feel that we could pursue anything because we didn't know. He was already going through a lot of the PTSD. He had multiple symptoms. But we came to find out that the two extra dog tags were the dog tags of these two men. Now, I need to say that the Marines did an investigation, and they claimed that they could never substantiate that. But to us, it didn't matter. We believe her son. So Jeff was having a difficult time after he returned. He came back, in July 13th of 2003.
And how old was he then?
He was 22 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back, and he seemed to be fine. We can remember the police had escort, and everybody was coming back, and he was tanned. He had lost a little bit of weight, but he was smiling, and physically he was unscathed.
And how long had he served over there in total, Kevin?
He went there in January, so he was there about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So after coming back, the Marines had warned everybody, you know, there may be some changes. And we did notice that he was drinking a little bit more than we had seen him before, but we just figured it was readjustment. His girlfriend, though, of 6 years, had told us that they went away to Cape Cod, to Hyannis, and Jeff refused to leave the hotel. He didn't want to go out, and he said he had seen enough sand to last him a lifetime. And so that was the only real strange thing until Christmas Eve, December 24th of 2003. Jeff, for the first time, refused to go with us down to his grandparents. And we, remembering what the Marines had stated, we didn't force the issue. And his sister, though, came back a little bit early and found Jeff in our kitchen with tears in his eyes. And she asked him what was wrong, and he didn't answer right away. And then he took off his dog tags. This is the only other time that we knew he took off the dog tags. And he tossed them at his sister, crying, saying, "I'm nothing more than a murderer." Well, that was his younger sister, and she became very upset. So she did go outside. She called us. We came home. Jeff wouldn't really talk to us about anything. He had calmed. And, you know, we made a lot of mistakes in all this, and that night we wrote it off as just a bad experience. We were thinking with a parent's heart. And we should have pursued it, and we never did. So the next day, Christmas, he was fine. It was like the old Jeff was back. So during the intervening months, things seemed to be going okay. He was in school. He had a job over in the school. But then his birthday came. His birthday was March 18th. So it was the day before the war began, the war's anniversary, and he was also on school vacation. And that day, everything fell apart for him. All of a sudden, everything just exploded, the symptoms. The drinking became much more. He started isolating himself. He was very angry. Never angry at us or a family, but angry about the situation, angry about the nation, angry about the war. And what happened is that we tried to get him help. We wanted him to go to the VA, but he refused because he said if he went to the VA, his unit would find out, his career would be destroyed, and he had also applied to be a Massachusetts State Trooper.
And am I correct that he had previously gone to the VA, but that they had not genuinely helped him?
Not at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That occurred in May.
Mm-hmm.
So let me go to that time directly. On May 28th, it was Memorial Day weekend, Friday.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get Jeff to go with us, and he kept putting it off. We found out that the VA could not share his information with his unit. So then finally on May 28th, we left the house. At noontime, he was fine. He was going to get ready to go. But by 3 o'clock, he had already been into the alcohol. Alcohol had been much worse. We don't know where he got it from. and he was heavily intoxicated. So Julie, his girlfriend, and myself put Jeff in the car, and we went down to the VA, which is about an hour from us. And when we went down there, it took about 6 hours to finally get him in. The VA wanted him to voluntarily enter. He wouldn't, so we had to do an involuntary commitment.
Mm-hmm. How long did you have to wait for help for him there at the VA?
Well, the strange thing is we thought he was getting help. We thought that they were assessing him. Regretfully, up to this day, Jeff was never diagnosed.
With PTSD.
With PTSD.
So they, in fact, did not diagnose him with PTSD. Therefore, he was not qualified by their standard to receive assistance for PTSD, for help for PTSD.
Correct.
Right, right. And let me just interject something here, if I may. And I'm sure you know this, Kevin, and Peter, you probably know this as well, and I'm not sure if our listeners know this. Certainly veterans listening will know this, and families of veterans may well know this. There are approximately 1,000 veterans who attempt suicide per month. Approximately 1,000. And approximately 18 of those men and women succeed in killing themselves every month. So I want everyone to listen up as Kevin continues with his sad story. Please go on.
Well, we brought him down on that Friday, and then my wife got a call on the following Tuesday. That was June 1st, so he went on Friday the 28th, and on June 1st, it was Jeff calling her and said, come and pick me up. I'll be waiting outside. That was shocking to us. We didn't really expect that. But she went, and she picked him up, and nobody ever talked with us. There was never... There was one nurse, a male nurse, who was also an ex-Marine, and he and Jeff bonded. He called just to check in on Jeff, and they were supposed to go out for dinner. But then what happened was that evening he went over to his girlfriend's for the last time, and then he came home the following day. On June 3rd, he got into a single car accident, which totaled our family car, but he was fine. He was safe. He landed between two trees. No one could figure out what happened. He wasn't drunk, though, because the police did respond, and they gave him a breathalyzer, and he was fine. On May 28th, when he entered the VA, just to let you know, 3 hours after we had arrived there, they gave him a breathalyzer, and he blew a .328, which is high, and yet he was functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So then June 5th came along. That was the day he was supposed to have graduated with his sister. And due to the fact that he fell apart and couldn't have attended school, they stated to him he would be allowed to graduate to march in the pomp and circumstance, but what they would do is hold his degree until he could get help. The college was very wonderful for him. Mm-hmm. But he went there. He did not walk in the ceremony. But he broke through the crowd and hugged his sister as she was going up for her diploma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that day turned very bad. And we called the VA and we told them that he was much worse than he was beforehand. And we tried to get him to go to the VA. He finally agreed to, provided that I didn't go. So his grandfather and his two sisters brought him up to the VA, but Jeff wouldn't go into the building, and they never called a doctor to come down to assess him. And so they had to bring Jeff back home. And during that time, we went through the house, we disabled his car, and we went through the house taking anything that could harm him. We hit it. Well, during the intervening time, he came back. Things got worse. And then on June 14th, Joyce, his mother, called the VA and said, "We are watching our child die." In fact, well, that was on June 15th. June 14th, Jeff was sitting in front of our fireplace with tears in his eyes, and I had purchased a book about PTSD, and he was going through the symptoms, saying he had this, and he said he was going crazy. He stopped drinking that day. So the next day, June 15th, Joyce called the VA, and that was when we found out that a thing called the Vet Center existed. So Jeff himself, along with his mother, called the Vet Center and made an appointment for the 18th. Jeff stopped drinking during that period of time. Joyce called and said, he's ready. He needs the help now. And they gave us an appointment for Friday the 18th. And so one of our biggest concerns is that this nation wasn't ready to even care for our vets, not at that point, and still is not. So what happened is I brought him into the Vet Center. Jeff asked me to come into the appointment, and so I sat in and I filled in as much as I could. And then we went up to a camp that we had volunteered for years, and they were having an anniversary party, and regretfully they had open bar. Mm-hmm. So Jeff started drinking, and we left the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeff and I came home. It was Father's Day. And Jeff stayed to his room, didn't really associate. He wasn't drinking at that point. And then I went to work on Monday, June 21st, came home, and I walked in to find Jeff in a total rage. He was angry about the war, and then he started telling me he was going to commit suicide. I called up the Vet Center, and this wonderful person talked me down, talked Jeff down. In fact, they spoke twice. But during one of the phone calls, and it's in their records, Jeff said, "No one cares enough to help." And I think that was the most horrible indictment against the system that could ever be said.
And how soon after did he die, my dear?
Well, that night, Jeff came to me at 11:30. He asked if he could sit in my lap and rock. And we did for about 45 minutes. I came back from work the next night, June 22nd. Couldn't find Jeff. His dog tags were neatly placed on his bed, which was made. And then I saw a light down in our cellar. And I saw that there was a shrine of pictures. His platoon picture was in the middle with some blood on it. Family pictures and a half moon surrounded that. And his battalion coin was at the base. And then I saw Jeff. I thought he was standing, but he was hanging from a hose, which he had told the VA that he had bought. And he was in my lap for the last time as I tried to support him, taking the noose from around his neck. So, Jeff had died.
And what was that day?
June 22nd, 2004.
And Jeff became another statistic.
Correct. Well, not really, Patricia. See, they don't count Jeff.
They don't count Jeff.
No. He is among the uncounted, unacknowledged casualties of this war.
That's right. That is correct. And there are thousands upon thousands of uncounted casualties of this war and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it goes on and on while we spend one of every five of our tax dollars, one of every five of our dollars is spent on these wars, which is outrageous. And now, as you've told me, Kevin, Jeffrey has been honored. Can you tell us about that honor? And then we're going to have Peter speak up some and give us some facts and figures.
On March 18th of last year, the Veterans for Peace, Chapter 041, on Cape Cod, they renamed their chapter after Jeff. And to our knowledge, and to their knowledge, it was the first time that a chapter of Veterans for Peace has ever been designated for a service member, a veteran who had committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
What was wonderful about this is that they've committed the chapter to lobby to address suicide and to address suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm.
At the present time, the suicide rates are still astronomically high.
They're staggeringly high. Yes. And the VA is still doing everything in their power to cover up these facts and these deaths, refusing to acknowledge the truth of the impacts of war. These wars that we are fighting needlessly because we are not bound to win these wars. And yet, as I said earlier, one out of every five of our federal dollars is spent to fight these wars. We are spending $700 billion per year ongoingly to fight these wars. Money that could be spent on health care, that could be spent on health care for civilians and soldiers, money that could be spent in schooling, money that could be spent to improve the quality of our lives here in this country. And in fact, right now, our non-defense discretionary funding is lower than it has ever been since 1976, which is appalling in my book, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. And Peter, I know that you have some unique insight into spending of these wars and as well as the cause of these wars. Can you tell us briefly about your experience in Palestine and how Palestine is impacting these wars and in fact is directly responsible for the wars that are underway?
Thank you, Patricia, and thank you, Kevin. So sorry to hear the story, and I think one thing Patricia had mentioned was that I would have some facts and figures, but before I share some of that, I just want to say that the organization I work for, the American Friends Service Committee, one of the signature projects that we were involved with soon after the beginning of the war in Iraq in 2003 was something that was called Eyes Wide Open, and it featured a pair of combat boots for each American soldier who had been killed in the war. And back at that time, increasingly through 2004, 5, 6, and 7, really, there was a denial and there was an effort to hide from people the cost that this war was having on U.S. soldiers. And one of the things we found with this exhibit, which we toured around the country, was that the most powerful voices that we could feature at these events were the voices of military families. And Kevin's family is one who has been a very powerful message for so many of the communities who have seen Eyes Wide Open. And I think we've started to look at all the hidden costs, all of the denied costs that go on, and maybe in some ways the worst is what happened to young men and women, period, who return from war and are so emotionally distraught. May I just
intervene very briefly? As we speak of these wars, I want to remind people that this war in the Middle East began with Desert Storm. It did not begin in 2003. It began in Desert Storm. And I want to inform people that of the 500,000 or more soldiers that served in Desert Storm, to date, amongst those people, we have 73,846 young men and women who have died prematurely as a consequence of that war, primarily because they too are not getting help for undiagnosed illnesses caused by exposures to American weaponry fashioned from so-called depleted uranium, which is radioactive material that has been fashioned into tank and artillery warfare and was debuted in Desert Storm. So of that number of soldiers that served in Gulf War One, as we call it, or Desert Storm, we have about 74,000 soldiers dead. We have, of that number, we have disability claims, of approximately 408,000 people. So therefore, if I might, as we speak of these wars, let us include the suffering caused by Desert Storm as well. Forgive me, Peter, for interrupting you, but I thought it important to mention that too.
Oh, sure. I think as many people realize, we often only see or often hear only the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, about the impact of war and what it does to communities,
mm-hmm.
both in this country and certainly in the countries where these wars are being fought.
It's true, and sadly, I'm sure, you probably know this, Peter, and others might know this, General Tommy Franks, who led warfare against Iraq, famously quoted, "We don't do body counts." So therefore, the numbers of civilians who have died in Iraq and also in Afghanistan remains an unknown quantity. But what we do know is that the American deaths, and when one sees the numbers of soldiers who have died on their news programs, and those numbers are quoted or cited perhaps at the end of the week as on PBS or some other station, what we're really seeing here is a number of soldiers who have died in country, killed in action. What we are not seeing is the men and women, we're not seeing the numbers of men and women killed or dying in hospitals or those who come home and die. But according to military, the Department of Defense, since 2003, they will own up to 4,488 deaths in Iraq. So, and that's actually killed in action. So there's so much that we're not learning about and so much that we don't know about. So please go on, Peter.
Sure. And I think, you know, as we think of kind of these hidden costs that you were mentioning, one, I do want to sort of throw out an idea and an opportunity I think that we have right now, and that's to find a way to take advantage of this discussion about the debt to make sure that Pentagon spending is included
right.
in the kind of reductions that desperately need to be made in our country. And I can't say I have heard any hints about this in really the mainstream press, but I think it's coming. And in just the last few days since the election, everybody's focused on the fiscal cliff and sequester and the failure of the super committee to do their job last summer. But what I really think it means for us in a broader peace movement, and certainly for us, which includes so many veterans' families, is that this is an opportunity to refocus our message on the financial costs.
Absolutely. What is the current defense budget, Peter, and what is the projected budget for the following year?
Well, I mean, the defense budget is enormous. I mean, it's immoral and it's unsustainable to shy away from all the numbers that numb us. I think it's important to realize that since 1998, the amount of money that we spend on defense has doubled.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And probably in 98, we certainly were the world's leader in investing our resources in the military. And so so now the United States alone spends more money than most of the rest of the world combined.
More than 17 nations combined.
Yeah,
that's correct, including China.
Amazing.
So it's a disgrace. It's a crime, and what we're leaving the generations to follow. But really, you know, more importantly, it's a crime when you look at what this has done to the rest of the world as they either seek to keep up with us in some fashion on spending for the military. But B, you know, not all of our investment in the military, in militarism, is just in our country. And sometimes what is just as damaging is the alliances we make and the way we convince other countries to also see their security through being highly militarized.
That is correct.
So,
let me remind you, as you say that we are now deploying forces to Australia and Singapore.
We're deploying. We have bases all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're deploying forces all over the world. We're offering weapons systems to repressive and aggressive governments
mm-hmm.
that we happen to like all over the world. And so I think, you know, the tentacles of militarism are deep. One thing I was struck by, there was an article in the New York Times, an op-ed, a couple days ago after the election, and it was from an adjunct professor at one of the war colleges,
mm-hmm.
maybe Annapolis, but I forget which one.
Mm-hmm.
But he talked about, he started his article with, you know, looking back at the title of his article was about militarism in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did is he went beyond simply the notion that we have a powerful military and spend lots of money on the military, but to say that we have also become a militarized society. And he made the link to sporting events being linked to the military and the war. He made the link to popular culture and fashion mm-hmm. being connected to the military, but more specifically to the wars that we're fighting right now. And so he went beyond sort of that famous phrase from Eisenhower in talking about a military-industrial complex and really was starting to explore what militarism has done to the psyche of our country. And I think that is the mantle that the broader peace movement needs to pick up. And perhaps the best way to start is to insist or find a way to be effective in our arguments on the need to cut military spending.
I agree with you. And let me add something to this. We are talking about the spending that we know is routinely publicized as expenditures by the Department of Defense. But what is not routinely publicized is the monies that are spent by the State Department for more ongoing warfare. And we have, by the State Department, we have, their budget is $51.6 billion for 2013, of which $43.4 billion funds long-term national security mission of the department, and $8.2 billion supports extraordinary and temporary costs of civilian-led programs in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. In short, those contractors that are on the ground over there, making an average of $150,000 to $250,000 a year, whereas a young or a corporal serving in the United States military or in the U.S. Army makes $19,000 or $20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself is a disgrace. But the point I'm making here is that we speak of the monies that we know are going out the door. We know that we're pouring our life, the life's blood of this nation, into war. But sadly, all too often and most frequently, while Hillary Clinton looks certainly and is beginning to look increasingly presidential, I might add, as she talks of the plans of the State Department and her activities, we do not hear of the fact that the State Department is now and should be called the Department of War, as it is engaged in warfare that we are not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most disturbing changes in the last, probably we've noticed it recently, but I think in the last few decades that the State Department has become, is walking hand in hand with the visions and with the direction, certainly in the Middle East, from the military. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One thing that comes to mind is as we prepare for a week of analysis on the resignation of General Petraeus is that in many ways I think he is going to be looked back upon as an individual who was really at the center of how this country responded to 9/11. And how we pursued what's become an ongoing worldwide war on terror, and I think you can see kernels of this with his record in Iraq during the Iraq War, when he was first moved to Mosul before he was the commander for the entire war. One of the first things that many of us noticed who were involved with community groups and organizing in Iraq was that that corruption followed him, and that the efforts to suppress Al-Qaeda in Mosul which is what we were told in the mainstream press, was actually predicated on buying off allies and distorting any sort of system that was ground up or embedded in the desires of Iraqis. And I think as he progressed and as his ideas gained more credence within the military, and I think, in fact, eventually becoming the creed and the counterinsurgency movements, that, you know, that what I hope people will start to talk about is not the trauma he's caused his family with this affair, but the trauma he's caused our country with pushing these policies that have really been a big part of why so many people in the world fear us as a country.
Well, I would say that learned and thoughtful people will look back upon Petraeus's general betray us, perhaps, as they contemplate the role that he has played in these wars. And I find it extremely interesting that his downfall comes about as an act of adultery, when in fact he is an orchestrator of mass murder and torture. And I find it mind-boggling that he would now fall prey to a charge of adultery. But thank you.
Well, one of the, I mean, I am reminded of, you know, the energy around the resignation of General McChrystal. And at that time, I still recall our message, which was, you know, let's change the policy as you're about to change the general. And, you know, I worry that we're repeating ourselves and not going to have that sustained discussion about the policy. And not
exactly. And let's briefly talk about what Betrayus left behind. As we know, through the heat of the war, there was much discussion in Iraq about the possibility of fair elections. And that was then, and today now, that's still going on, as Sunni Arabs and other minorities continue to complain about the fact that they're being shut out of power. So that hasn't changed. Electricity in Iraq, for years after the invasion, Iraqis relied almost solely upon generators and often had power for only a few hours a day. That was then, and now today, that has changed very little as well. And for oil production, as you know, recovered after the initial fighting. Perhaps you know that. I'll bet you do know that. But as it stands now, production is still below the pre-war peak. And as it concerns Abu Ghraib, that filthy prison, that bastion of hell, we know that as those wars, at the peak of that war over there, that U.S. troops were torturing detainees. And sadly, more than likely, this is still going on there. It's still open, and there are ongoing reports that the Iraqi government is now torturing detainees in secret prisons, including that one. So tell, what has really changed in Iraq, and how has the United States improved the lives of Iraqis, and how have we brought about democracy? This is the preposterous claim we make as we march into war, that we're there to bring about democracy, when clearly it's not true. Am I right?
I'd be interested to hear Kevin's thoughts as well.
But I would.
The one thing I could say, and this is brief, is, you know, the one gift, if there could be one, is that most of the U.S. troops are gone. That's the only gift. I see.
Most of the U.S. troops are gone, but we still have thousands of U.S. contractors on the ground over there being funded by state.
No, I understand that.
Right.
I think most of your question is rhetorical.
Mm-hmm. Of course it is.
We brought death and destruction.
Of course it is.
The one thing, and this has a lot to do with the Iraqis themselves and their insistence that they would not grant any form of immunity to U.S. troops, is the main reason the U.S. troops are out of Iraq, and I think that's the one thing I can be kind of grateful for. The one other point I would make, and I think this is important to keep stating over and over again, is that you need to simply look no further than the passions that started a couple years ago with the Arab Spring to see what type of change the world embraces. If you look at the changes in Tunisia and then in Egypt, you saw countries around the Arab world, governments around the Arab world that immediately were worried about a bottom-up call for change, a bottom-up call for economic freedoms, for more political liberties, for the opportunity to choose their own form of government. And you actually saw countries around the Arab world start to make sort of modest reforms in an effort to get in front of their people who saw what happened in Tunisia and saw what happened in Egypt and were asking for the same for themselves. And I mention that because after the U.S. went, you know, first into, this is following 9/11, but always in Iraq, but first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, you didn't see any other governments in the region sort of saying that they were worried about the type of change that was taking place in Iraq. What it was and what everyone understands it to be was a war of aggression to change a regime, and nobody wanted that to be the model. And in the simplest way to understand how U.S. militarism is seen around the world is to look at the way the people in the Arab world, but around, you know, certainly broadly speaking, the Islamic world, are looking at the revolutions that started in Tunisia and Egypt and wanting to model that as a form to really get some democratic rights and justice in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are coming very soon to the end of this program, but I would be remiss, Kevin, if I did not extend my deep sympathy and tell you that I and everyone else listening to your story of your son's death, we are all deeply moved and grateful to you for sharing that story today on Veterans Day. I can't think of anything more important that could be said as Veterans Day this year comes to a close soon, and when in fact most people are honestly not contemplating the suffering of our veterans and sadly are not demanding that our government appropriately care for our veterans. I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate, which is a project that was seeded by a grant I received from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And I want all listeners to know that I am here to assist you however I can, in any way that I can. And I'm going to give my number, and then I want each of you, please, Kevin and Peter, if you would give your numbers out so that anyone listening would care to follow through and speak with you about some of the things we've touched upon today, that would be terrific. My number is 775-412-5980, 775-412-5980. And Kevin is there to help other parents who are dealing with some of the same problems that he's dealt with. Kevin, will you give your number?
Of course. Our number is area code 413-283-6070.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yes. Our number is 413-283-6070.
And Peter, I'm sorry we didn't get around to discussion of Palestine, but I would like to invite both of you back on this program for part two. Are you both up for that?
Definitely.
Peter, what do you say to that?
That would be super.
Yeah, please. All right. So, listeners, I want you to tune in for a second edition of this program called Clean Lies, Dirty Wars, America's Addiction to War. And Peter, would you please give your number and tell us very briefly, too, about the American Friends Service Committee?
Sure. The American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker organization established during World War One as a way to offer alternatives to military service for young men. Quakers, there's with the Peace Churches, Mennonites and Quakers. And many young Quakers were ambulance drivers and had other types of service in the First World War, but not picking up a weapon. And we've continued that passion for almost 100 years now.
And actually, well before that, the Quakers were amongst the first to fight for justice for all, including taking up the staff to fight against slavery. Am I right on that, dear?
I'm sorry,
Taking up the staff to fight against slavery.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes, so the efforts of the Quakers, which have morphed into the American Friends Service Committee, date back well before World War One to the days of slavery, and they have fought long and hard in the name of peace and justice. Peter, would you give your telephone number?
Sure. It's area code 215-241-7170.
And again, Peter?
It's in Philadelphia, so area code 215-241-7170.
Well, folks, when you hear our theme song come on, which is Respect, you will know that we'll be signing off, and we are very glad to have joined with you tonight on this night in particular. And there it comes. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, and I want to wish you all the best. Soldiers, veterans, don't give up the fight. Call, reach out for help. If we can help you, we'll be there for you. Thank you for joining us. And thank you. Kevin, Peter, part two will come up on this.
Okay, no, very well.
Thank you. And I don't know if we can talk over this or not.